This is Bumper Mo, and you're listening to Bitcoin Uncensored.
What's up, party people? We are here on the floor at NABC 2016. In front of us is the conference organizer himself, Mo.
Bumper Mo!
Mo, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Mo, what do you think of this year's conference related to other conferences? What have been the themes? What have set this conference apart from prior years?
As you know, this is the best, most influential conference in the Bitcoin business. And as you know, this is on every single person's calendar, the first major event of the year. So there's not much more to say about it. I mean, we have the top speakers in the industry, both Bitcoin speakers, we've got blockchain speakers, we've got fintech guys, we've got the most influential people from around the world traveling from 40, 50 different countries coming right here to hear the speakers.
You ain't Pumper Mo for no reason. So, Mo, you want to tell us a little bit about the sponsor this year? You have Dash Coin. Last year was Paycoin. Who's the main sponsor this year? Is it Dash?
The main sponsor is not Dash this year.
Okay. It's the internet private?
We have over here the Bitcoin.com and private internet access.
Excellent. Okay, so they're the main sponsors this year.
Yeah.
Bitcoin.com is Roger Ver's venture, no?
Yep.
And what are the other big... So private internet access, I think, is the other big sponsor this year.
Use your words.
I mean, it seems to me like there's less of a focus on sponsors and more of a focus on actual like attendance this year. Do you think that's true? Is that
good? This is a community event. This is one of the few events which are not just fully commercial focused to sell to exhibitor space. This brings the exhibitors and community together to network, meet with each other, build relationships, and that's what it's known for.
How did you end up kind of picking Miami as a venue for your first North American Bitcoin conference, which we were at, which was neat because it was like where BitShares was announced and Ethereum was announced and NeoMB was announced. It was one of my favorite conferences, frankly. So how did you end up like with Miami?
Miami's one of these fantastic places that where the South meets the North. North America, South America have huge connections to Miami. It's hot in January. Everybody wants to be here. And we've got people like you that make it such an inviting and welcoming place.
Well, when you're down here, where do you get your cocaine? That's really what we all want to know. It's Miami. It's one of the deepest cocaine markets in the world. What do you pay and where do you get it?
Right. We talked about this last night when you introduced me to your dealer.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so you know where I get it, and we get it in the same place.
Excellent. Okay, well, I was just hoping that maybe...
I trust you.
Yeah.
So whatever you say...
How was that shit?
The 8-ball was quickly
used. Well, you went for the whole 8-ball. Wow.
Yeah. go hard or go home.
Yeah, exactly. This is Bitcoin. You commit. So you also have done the Permission Ledger Conference, I think, in South California in November.
California. Yeah.
Try it again?
Yeah. Los Angeles.
California.
Yes.
Good. Chris isn't so good with words.
Yeah,
he's the second dumbest man in Bitcoin.
That 8-ball, I mean, send me straight. So, you know, a little numb in the mouth.
That's why he holds the audio gear and doesn't use the audio gear.
What's the turnout for the permission ledger space right now relative to Bitcoin? Because it seems like the permission ledger space is where really all of the, excitement seems to be happening.
Listen, both industries are young. Permission ledger, blockchain stuff, both are quite young. Bitcoin is a bit older in that there's more conferences about them. Blockchain is a little bit more hyped right now, particularly in places like New York and San Francisco. But there's no way to tell which is bigger, which is smaller. They're both interesting.
And a question regarding permission ledgers versus the Bitcoin. Mm. In 5 years,
can
do you think...
tweet while we talk?
You absolutely can. In 5 years, do you think you're going to still be doing a permission ledger conference, or do you think you're more likely to be doing a Bitcoin conference?
So the way I do conferences is I sort of track the industry. You know, like McDonald's found out that like their food is really shit for people, and they started serving salads, and then everybody's happy, and now they have salad wraps.
But they still eat shit.
Right, but they have salad wraps. So my conferences need to track the industry. So whether or not it's blockchain, whether or not it's Bitcoin, whether it's Vitalik Coin.
Vitalik Coin? That's a good idea. I think that's called Ether.
Well, you know, Tatiana Coin and all the other...
Yeah, sure, yeah. It's Tatiana Coin for Vitalik.
I'm super long Tatiana Coin, by the way.
I'm the counterparty guy, so why not? I'll win that with you.
But, I got it changed according to the times.
All right.
If it's a Miami coin or a Coke coin like you proposed the other night.
I'm absolutely into Coke coin. Yeah. Chris is a heroin addict, however, so, like, I don't know that he would be using that a lot. We want to see an efficient market hypothesis conference. Is there any merit to that? Do you think that anyone would show up besides us and like four listeners? What do your metrics show on this market?
A journey of 1,000 steps begins with one.
Mo, that's a platitude. That's a platitude, Mo.
We got to start somewhere. You know, three people, we'll build it out. It's not about having. There's something about pies. There's an analogy there. You know,
something about pies.
Building out the biggest pie rather than fighting over the same piece. We just want to build the big pie. So if we start out with this efficiency market bullshit, build it out to five people in a couple months, we'll be good, you know?
Chris once fucked the pie. They made a movie about it.
It's based off you.
Yeah.
Nice one. I mean, being there, done there, right? Hashtag YOLO, but...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. You were in the Israeli military, I heard, at one point. Mm-hmm. I mean, you must have had, like, some time to kill at one point or another. What you want to talk about?
Not only time.
People, too.
You want to tell anybody about your very interesting and colorful history and to give people an overview about how you became Mo at all and your journey to Bitcoin?
No, I prefer remaining mysterious.
Mo's a mysterious fellow.
Well, how about this? What is Bitcoin?
You kind of look like Indiana Jones with the cords wrapped around you. And tits.
Yeah.
What is Bitcoin like in Amsterdam right now? What can you tell us about that scene? Is it a big one? Is it growing, shrinking?
No, so there's a great event called Bitcoin Wednesday. It happens every month, and it's there's about anywhere from 30 to 100 people that go there. That's exciting. Couple local vendors, merchants. My cafe uses Bitcoin. They don't see much volume, but it grows. It's like any local market, right? There's the banks are interested in Bitcoin technology, but... a slow growth. Pete Rizzo.
Mr. Rizzo.
Oh, we have him
Rizzla.
Yeah, I did. I'm going to reply to him soon.
Did you get his email?
David. Bailey.
Here is the author of that piece.
Boom.
All right. See you soon.
There you guys.
All right. The Magazinos are hanging out.
We'll cut that.
We're going to check out the conference floor. We're going to check out the exhibitors. We're going to see what we see and put together, a pretty cool episode for our guests. So check us out.
Is this pod session over?
I mean, it's over when you want it to be, Mo. Do you want to, like, you got something else you want to do?
Let's freestyle.
You want to, like, take off your shirt a little bit?
I already did last night.
Would you go streaking for us?
Yes.
Yeah?
Nothing is quite as revealing as Miami Beach.
Yeah, no, I believe that.
What's the next conference coming up? Where can people check out more about what you're doing? What website should they go to?
Next conference is May 30th in Dubai, rooftop of the Burj Al Arab.
Hope there's no fires there at that hotel.
I also hope there's no fires at that hotel.
And what's the theme of the conference? Is that a Bitcoin conference?
No, it'll be probably a keynote event. Yeah. Find out more at www.google.com/search.
That works.
Just kidding.
After talking to the organizer for a bit, we moved on. We found Aaron Lasher of the Bread Wallet Project, also a Miami native. Let's follow up with him.
Hey, this is Aaron Lasher. I'm the CMO at Bread Wallet, and we're here at the Miami Bitcoin Conference. We got five guys really having a good time.
Nice. CMO, that's a pretty fancy title, Aaron. When did you start actually like working for Bread Wallet?
So I began as an investor, and I really liked their product and the team. But I think they had a need for marketing in general. So I created their marketing plan, and we have a roadmap, and all those fun marketing 101 things are on my plate.
So tell the audience a little bit about what makes Bread Wallet different.
Sure. So Bread Wallet is a consumer-facing Bitcoin wallet. It's a non-custodial wallet, as opposed to Coinbase, meaning that you actually hold your coins, and we provide the software for you to do that in a safe and reliable way. We think that the thing that differentiates us in the market is that people really like our user interface, and it's easy to introduce new users and grandma, if you will, to the Bitcoin world.
Right. Now, I know you here because you are a resident of South Florida, and we've crossed paths multiple times. Have you lived here all your life? Have you moved here recently? How long have you been in South Florida?
I was born here, but I have a sort of illustrious past history. I used to live in, I grew up in Belgium. I lived there for 10 years. And
I didn't know that.
I also spent 2 years sailing around the world, so I called my boat my home for a while as well.
We got to get an invite on that boat at some point, because that boat sounds fantastic. Last time I was talking to you, I think you were doing some work on it.
Yeah, well, you know what boat stands for, right?
Yeah, it's
Remind me. It's an old Florida joke.
Break out another thousand.
Yeah, no kidding. It's the story of every boat. So where did you kind of discover Bitcoin? And I know you've told me before, you know, kind of your Bitcoin journey. And we don't usually do these Bitcoin journey shows, but I don't think we've ever really talked about you at all. So why don't you just introduce people to, like, how you kind of arrived at Bitcoin and right here even at Bread Wallet?
Sure. So I'm a mathematician by trade, and I love number theory. And one of the coolest things about number theory is we had most of it well understood and established 5 or 6 centuries ago. And it wasn't until we had modern banking and computers where it really became useful. So I'm really entertained by this sort of paradigm of stuff that's true but not useful that then becomes useful. And when I heard about Bitcoin in 2011, just the application of cryptography and number theory to money itself was intoxicating.
Did you have any relation to like the cypherpunks before this, or is that like, were you new to the space and sort of the application of cryptography to money when you heard of Bitcoin? Is that the first you kind of like explored that?
Well, I've always been sort of an armchair political scientist, so I think that I was probably philosophically aligned with cypherpunks, but I was not involved in the community to a great extent.
I have an elementary understanding of what number theory is. Do you want to give the audience a better than elementary understanding of what number theory is?
Sure. It's very elegant and simple in its description, but devilishly complex once you get into it. Number theory is the study of the natural numbers. So that's 0 through infinity, whole numbers. And that's where you start. And then you...
I thought there was more to it, though, like dealing with like varying... I thought there was more than just the whole numbers. I thought that you could deal with equations and how they would act in different like basis denominations or something like that? Once you deal with like the set of like rational numbers versus complex numbers, is that right?
Well, when you talk about bases, for instance, binary, tertiary, what have you, that's number theory, right? That's counting above that number and then moving on to the next, what we call decimal points because we operate in base 10. But technically, it's whole numbers. Now, of course, math is a rich and broad category, so the number theory will get tied in with, for instance, elliptical cryptography. It's not just whole numbers along the way. Here's one distinction. Remember, if it's as long it is rational numbers, so that has to be clear. If you have a decimal point, it's still a whole number in its own right. It's an arbitrary distinction in many ways.
Okay. So are you here for tonal reasons? Is that what brought you here?
I'm sorry, for what reasons?
The tonal reasons? Are you aware of the tonal purposes here?
Tonal? I don't think I understand your question.
Luke, you want to explain this, John Seth?
Well, I mean, Luke Dash Jr. is really into tonal, which apparently is a base 16 measurement system.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I haven't taken a look at that, but I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I would find interesting to hear
Chris
about.
Chris and I actually have become tonal evangelists. We're
I mean, I didn't know what makes tonal any different than base 16, other than I guess that would end up being, in Luke's explanation, a new way to, like, I don't know, have standard weights and measures, which themselves then, you know, have different definitions of inches versus feet based on,
right,
you
I
know,
think it's
powers of 16 or something.
Tonal would be the application of base 16 to measurement, right?
I think so. Do you want to weigh out of this?
I mean, as tonal experts.
Well, I mean, you educate me on this, I suppose.
You gotta talk to Luke. He has a very developed theory. Hopefully we'll get him on the show. He's very shy on camera. Off camera, he's like one of the most interesting people we ever deal with, which is such like a frustrating thing for our audience.
Well, you guys are a little intimidating, so I can understand why someone would, you know, shy away.
That is true.
They're intimidated by our stupidity.
No comment.
Now, you were a judge at the hackathon this year. And do you want to tell, people what you're looking for in an application, what you're looking for in a project? Because we haven't even talked about it. I'm a judge as well. But what in your mind do you think is the qualities of a successful pitch to the hackathon this year?
Sure. Well, I was just going to ask Chris DeRose what he thought. And then probably
nothing smart,
not in agreement, and say, yeah, that's what I thought too. No, I, honestly, I'm a little bit nervous because I'm not a great coder. I know more about programming than the average person, but I will struggle to evaluate their code on its merits as code. So what I'm going to probably focus on is the problem they're trying to solve, and you know, whether it works.
It's a hackathon, so if you have good code at a hackathon, either you're the most talented person in the world or you manage your time poorly. So I think in my mind, it's about what you came up with more so than how it was constructed, because any hackathon project is going to be held together with duct tape if it's done right, because you're gonna be flying right on the lines there of like getting it in time. So yeah, I think for me, what I'm looking for is creativity in terms of what is actually being achieved, and perhaps like novelty in that sense. And then secondary to that would probably be the presentation. Like, did you do a cool job of explaining this, or maybe a GUI that was like frictionless or something like that? That's what I would probably advocate. Although we have to probably talk about that later with the other judges tonight.
Well, if that's what you think, Chris, then I agree.
Okay, then that's nice and easy. Well, where can people find out more about you if they want to learn either about BreadWallet or yourself?
So we're pretty active on Bitcoin-related channels, but I think we need to do a better job of making ourselves accessible. And so we are revamping our website. That'll be a good location. And we're also engaging in all sorts of other ways. So you'll hear about us, we hope. And we really look forward to meeting some new people.
Give them a URL. Give them a handle. Give them something. Call to action.
Sure. So breadwallet.com.
So Aaron, well, last thing for me, you're one of the few married Bitcoiners.
How has your wife not left you? You're into Bitcoin,
right? I mean, do you have any like advice for Bitcoiners out there? Maybe
Luke did too. Maybe mathematicians are like, they figured out the formula.
Maybe that's what's going on here.
Keeping your woman around while you're a Bitcoiner.
Luke and Aaron are the only two married Bitcoiners. One of the only two. There's a few others, but they dress better. So do you have any advice, marital advice for Bitcoiners out there?
I don't know, man. You just got to lock it down. Like, once you fool one, that's all it takes. And
got to scam them.
If they believe in you, just, you know, make it true.
Do you hide your Bitcoins from your wife, or does she know like where they all are?
No, but I do have a funny story about that. So I acquired most of my coins in 2011. I still buy them all the time. I have something of an obsession, which I think is shared by many Bitcoiners. But I married my wife in late 2012. And it wasn't until the fun started in 2013 that I said, hey honey, we got these things, magic internet money, check
these
it out.
Internet beans,
and she's actually, I'm very fond
she was
of
like,
my
thank
wife.
Thank you, I'll take half.
No, she's wonderful. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman, and she's very bright, and she gets it, and I like hanging out with her and talking about Bitcoin, because she usually just takes over. But I do have to, you know, be careful, because once I get started, like many Bitcoiners, I can't stop, and she has to maybe tell me to shut up every now and then.
I like this thought. Honey, the neckbeard shekels. My train has arrived.
Well, we're retired now, baby.
Yeah.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for coming on the show. You're welcome anytime. Open invite. So let us know, and have fun at the conference.
Pleasure, guys.
After talking to Aaron Lasher, we saw Paul Snow in the halls, and, well, we tried to talk to him about what's new with Factum, but let's hear what happened.
This is Paul Snow, and you're listening to Bitcoin Uncensored.
This is Paul Snow, you're listening
please,
to Bitcoin
Paul.
Uncensored.
Paul, you know we love you.
Come on, Paul.
I know you do.
Paul, you know we love you.
Paul, just 2 seconds.
No,
Paul Snow,
no,
you're listening
no.
to Bitcoin
Paul,
Uncensored.
Paul, you get a chance to like correct the record, fix it, tell us everything, you know, what you think.
I correct the record all the time.
No. Are you a little drunk right now?
Absolutely not.
Do you have fun last night?
Yeah, had a nice dinner.
Any cocaine, marijuana involved?
Oh, I think he needs a cold shoulder, Josh. That was Paul Snell. Thank you, Paul, for your contribution.
Bitkong.me. Try your luck at a brand new game and see if you can multiply your bitcoins or lose them all. 100% verifiably fair on the Bitcoin blockchain. Give it a try now. Bitkong.me.
After Paul, we ran into a couple guys that were really enthusiastic to introduce themselves. And, well, it was a good conversation. They were from CoinVault. Let's go hear what they have to say about the ATM business over there in Texas.
We have Nick Morpheus out of the Matrix and Sheldon Whitehouse, representative from Rhode Island. Here with what's your name, Sheldon? What?
Sheldon Weisfeld from Houston, Texas.
Same thing. So you guys, tell us a little bit what you do here. Why you're here? You guys run an ATM network in Texas, right? Is it?
CoinVault ATM operates the first North American fully functioning buy and sell ATM out of Austin, Texas. Launched over 2 years ago.
And
you're
sell.
Still not in jail.
That's pretty tough.
And we are not in jail, although we have been audited. And this is the first, I guess, public recording that actually we did get an invitation to be looked at by the federal authorities that have jurisdiction. That'd be FinCEN, the BSA, by the IRS.
Have you been Roger verified?
We're Roger verified. We came out with a no recommendations report, so that was very exciting.
From Roger Ver, you really did?
Well, he did. He did mention about some interest in our machine at the gun shop in Austin. So
you're at the gun shop.
Yep.
Oh, I've seen you guys.
Yeah, yep, we provide a multicultural access, a 24-hour coffee shop. We're at the corner of 5th and Brazos at the handlebar. So if you need a cocktail and Bitcoin, or if you've got a battle to fight, you'll go to Central Texas Gun Works and either buy or sell Bitcoin and buy or sell your guns at the same time.
So it sounds to me like you two have not forgotten the Alamo.
Absolutely not. That'd be San Antonio, Texas. But then you move to Houston and you go to the world-famous George Brown Convention Center, where we have over 100 represented countries with facilities there that people travel in and out. They go to that ATM and they buy and sell Bitcoin. Amazing.
So can you talk a little bit about the demographics that you see purchasing Bitcoin from your ATMs? Are they mostly like poor black people?
Well, you know, so the interesting thing is, like, you know, whenever you look at the demographics, like, we come to these events and stuff and you expect it to be the techies, the young guy, the males.
Bet they're not.
And as soon as we, and then when I go through all of our registrations on the machine, like, you realize that it is, you know, basically the demographics of the city. We've got, you know, 60-year-old, you know, ladies that are trying to buy, you know, some of their knitting supplies online, you know, from China with Bitcoin.
Are there what kind of knitting supplies, like Flocka knitting supplies? Like, what are these knitting supplies?
Well, just like for arts and crafts type things.
That seems like an extraordinary claim to me. How do you know what they're spending them on?
Because they call in for customer service from time to time, and we chat with them about what their, you know, what their use case is, just because it helps us tailor our product to their needs and make sure that we're supporting our actual customers and not what we feel our customers might be.
What Chinese site takes Bitcoin for knitting supplies?
You know, I did not get that much information from her.
You know, I'll share a funny incident, because obviously, as one of the co-founders of CoinVault ATM, I put myself actually in the queue, so I provide customer service. And most recently, we had a customer at the ATM that called in that said, you know, those of you that are listening, you're familiar with Bitcoin, and you know there's a thing called an address, I don't care how you pronounce that, but it's an address. When the customer calls in and says, I scanned my driver's license 4 times and it won't send the Bitcoin.
That's funny. That's really funny. So these people are relatively new. What kind of rates are you charging on your Bitcoin?
Our ATM is one of the most aggressive rates. We're at 5%.
Got to charge more.
I agree.
Charge more.
14, 15, 18%.
We tell all ATM guys this. They don't believe us, and they end up agreeing with us.
Our strategy is in attempt to drive mainstream adoption. We have in Houston so many different industries that are serviced. I have a customer recently I spoke to that was doing some rather high-value transactions that is in the emerald trading business from Brazil. He uses Skype to review the emeralds real time. They bag them and serialize them. Huh. He pays for that transaction with Bitcoin real time, and the goods are shipped the same day.
So why is he using Coinbase?
Well, you'd say that here's a customer who's using cash. And so in that regards, perhaps his interest is to buy in cash, and that's his currency.
Bet he'd pay 9%.
Yeah, I mean, the issue is, like, we don't really consider ourselves a competitor to Coinbase because, with them, you're doing a bank transfer. It takes days. You know, you have to go through a whole process to get set up. With our machine, you can come, walk up to the machine, register in a couple of minutes, and instantly do your transaction. And you've got those Bitcoin in your wallet within minutes.
The impetus to CoinVault ATM was actually an experience that I had with Coinbase, where I bought Bitcoin in December of 2013, and I had to wait until a year later. Of course, that was January 2014, 7 days later, before the Bitcoin were available, and realized that if you're really going to drive mainstream adoption, the arduous process of registering, although we are fully compliant to FinCEN, BSA, counterterrorism, anti-money laundering, and all the other alphabets that
OFAC?
We're getting overrun with, the reality of it is, OFAC, of course, Office of Foreign Asset Control. The reality is, the customer who wants Bitcoin wants it now because they have a need for it now.
Heroin addicts.
That's not fair. We don't support any illicit or illegal use of Bitcoin, and we do go through the proper channels to verify our customers' validity if we deem that they are using for illegal or illicit activities.
You take them back.
We have a fiduciary responsibility to cease doing business with them.
Of course. And how many transactions per week are you guys averaging, would you say?
It's probably over 100.
Not bad. How many ATMs?
Four.
Four ATMs.
Yeah.
So on another note, to take it away from the ATM space, you guys are down in Texas, right?
Mm-hmm. We're in Texas. Nick's out of Los Angeles.
So you're down the road from like the Factum offices and Paul Snow and all those guys?
Absolutely. We've got an incredible ecosystem in Austin, having launched the first one in Austin, Texas. We were really instrumental in getting the law in Texas passed in April 2014, when Texas passed a ruling 1037, which so many of the other states are using as guidance. So it's exciting to be in this new frontier. Proverbially speaking, we are fighting the battle at the Alamo. It just happens to be the Bitcoin
right.
battle.
Tell me a little bit about how you guys got a bank account. Do you have one? Has that been a main source of friction for you guys? We hear from a lot of ATM guys that it's one of the hardest parts of the business is getting a business checking account. Is that your struggle?
I'll tell your listening audience they need to be aware. You know, big banks, I think, are afraid. They use all kinds of reasons. What I will share with you is we have banked with Wells Fargo, no longer. Bank of America, no longer. Chase Bank, no longer. E-Trade Bank, no longer. Frost Bank, no longer. So we've been through, and there's a list that continues, but you know, I share with you listening audience that, hey, this is a battle worth fighting. And there are bankers that will bank you. And so long as you're following all the rules and the regulations and you can demonstrate that to the more hometown banks, you will be able to be banked.
I mean, it seems like as a money transmitter that you are taking on the risk for your customers' behavior. That seems like basically the risk quotient you're asking for.
I'd like to restate that. We're not operating as a money transmitter. We are in the money service business.
Ah.
So as an MSB under FinCEN guidance, we operate within that framework of rules.
And under the regulations of the BSA, like banks definitely have the responsibility to know their customer's customer. You can't just go one level down. Like they have to know what's going on if they expect to be able to maintain a compliance system.
What is the difference between you and a money transmitter then? What is
a money transmitter holds customers' funds.
Okay.
We do not hold any customer funds. Once you buy the Bitcoin from us, the Bitcoin is yours. We have no control over it. Once you sell the Bitcoin to us, we've dispensed the cash to you. We're not holding any customer funds at any point in time.
It's a classic example of the customer that calls us. He's trying to send that Bitcoin to an address. We don't control that Bitcoin. They send it to the address of their liking. If they are using a Mycelium wallet or an Airbits wallet or any other number of wallets that are available, blockchain wallet, it's under their care, custody, and control. All we're doing is selling them Bitcoin from our available inventory, or we're buying their Bitcoin from them at that moment in time and dispensing cash. Our machines, currently we process up to $9,000 per day per customer is where our limits are set.
So I certainly don't particularly think you guys are a money transmitter, but I know that here in Florida, the state has been insisting that the Bitcoin ATM operators are money transmitters. Have you had any friction in your regulatory compliance efforts there, or has that not been so bad in Texas?
Well, we're pretty fortunate. Texas has took a stance early on in 2014. I've been instrumental in appealing to our authorities, both the banking side as well as the consumer and commercial side. I appealed to our Texas Alcohol Beverage Commission so that the licensed bars, clubs, and other restaurants that sell alcohol can also accept Bitcoin for payment. In fact, the regulators in Texas came out and said they can accept chickens for payment so long as they don't offer a discount on their alcohol, because we have a strong Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
That sounds very Texas.
Yeah.
Chris is a mother against drunk driving, actually. He's a
trans man.
He's a trans man.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's very interesting. Here in Florida, we kind of screwed up back in the 80s, and we have a really difficult time in our regulatory environment here with BTMs. In fact, I think we're the only state in the country, I've heard some stat, where structuring needs to be reported after like
$3,500
or
$3,000.
Something weird. Yeah, so.
That's typical for $3,000 is what, is typically where they start looking around.
Is it? Okay, I've heard it's unusually difficult here. We've had a number of BTM operators that have tried to operate in this state only to find out that, you know what, the other 49 states are much easier, and they leave.
You know, you have a challenge here. You've got such an easy access to the international port, so the propensity for nefarious type transactions are so high, and the common defined strategies of money laundering.
I just think it's that Florida man lives here.
Well, I don't know if it's Florida man or not, but I'll tell you that CoinVault ATM would like to come to Florida. We know there's a pent-up demand here in this marketplace. And the challenge is the regulatory climate, and we're all victims. I hate to say that, but we're victims of it. Hey, guys, thanks for the opportunity to share with you, and it's been a pleasure visiting with you here in Miami.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet if you do move to Florida, there's going to be a significantly different clientele that you're serving.
We have a tough clientele. You guys will hopefully find that out.
Your clientele
or not,
might
I don't
have
know.
Machetes here. So
Florida man is for real.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks a lot, guys. We really appreciate it. We'll let you know when the show's aired.
And last but not least today, we ran into Michael Turpin. Michael Turpin, who is, well, he's kind of been in all kinds of stuff. Let's talk to him about blockchains. That was a really interesting conversation.
Duo, we were wandering the halls and we saw...
We were wandering the halls of TNABC. We've run into the famed Michael Turpin of, Bit Angels, right? Bit Angels and...
Bit Angels and Transform Group.
Transform PR, is that...
Yep.
Excellent. So, Michael, do you want to introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about what you do, what you've done in the space, and, where you see Bitcoin going or whatever.
Sure. So I'm Michael Turpin. I'm probably best known in the space for co-founding Bit Angels in early 2013 with David Johnston, and really growing that to be the largest decentralized angel group globally for companies in Bitcoin and angel investors, and start bringing them together. It also spun off a few things. The DAPS fund, which David started, and I was a limited partner in. Was originally called the Bit Angels Fund, but we didn't want to get it confusing, and that was focused on DApps, on decentralized applications. So invested in MadeSafe and Factum and a number of other things. And David's now spending most of his time with Factum and some of his other portfolio companies. And then I also started the Bitcoin syndicate on AngelList with Gil Pincina and Nick Sullivan.
So you've been a big advocate of things like tokenization of projects, tokenization of decentralized apps, right? So can you talk a little bit about what the inspiration is there, why you think tokenization of apps is important, like Factum, for example, right?
What's
that?
Voxel
Group as well, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That was your recent one.
Yeah, so I think for the most part that, Bitcoin, and I know there are a lot of folks who are Bitcoin purists, obviously Counterparty, is sort of built as a layer on top of Bitcoin. I think in the next year or two, we're going to find, which of the models sort of finds adoption. I think it's going to be more of a fragmented rather than a winner-takes-all environment. In other words, I think right now it's about maybe 93% of the market cap is Bitcoin, and everything else, all the hundreds of other coins, are maybe 7%. I think as you get some that really get traction the way that Litecoin did at one point and that Ripple did at another point, I think you're going to find, and again, this is just personally a guess, based on just sort of my opinions and some of the things I see happening in the space, that 5 years from now you might see Bitcoin being maybe only two-thirds of the market,
sure,
of a much larger market. And you'll have things like we're working with Dash now. I'm very excited about Dash.
Are you investing in Dash?
I am.
Interesting.
Yep. And, I like what they're doing in terms of person-to-person. I like what Rootstock is doing in terms of taking a lot of the things that Ethereum has been doing on smart contracts, but then, like Counterparty, sort of, putting it, with an attachment as a sidechain to the original Bitcoin blockchain. I think the strength of Bitcoin going forward is going to be as a store of value, I'm certainly not the only one who feels that, and as sort of a reserve currency for everything else.
So, speaking of meta protocols, I've seen you a lot in the Counterparty chat, right? Like, I see you occasionally from now and then.
Well, I did PR for Counterparty
in
the old days, back when the original days, guys were there. And
They're still there.
I know, but I'm a frequent sort of critic of Counterparty of not having fulfilled its potential.
Sure. So, you were largely involved in the Mastercoin project, weren't you?
I was involved in the very early days of the Mastercoin project, and then sporadically since then with Omni.
Right. So, what's your involvement over there? And in Mastercoin, are you still involved over there these days? Or
we do some project work with Omni again on the public relations side. So, we're the number one PR firm in the space, and I try to take on interesting projects. I turn down anybody I think who's a scam coin or even that doesn't really kind of prove it to me. Sometimes I'm wrong. I've turned down some projects that turned out to be successful. But
what would those be?
I don't want to say who I turned down. Let's just say that some of them have not been successful, and at least one actually was successful, and then I worked with them after they kind of proved themselves.
So what ICOs have you been a part of where the value exceeded the ICO price after, say, like 6 months to a year?
Okay. So we were involved in the earliest days of Ethereum.
Sure.
When actually at this show 2 years ago.
You remember that?
Yeah. We were doing the PR for CryptoKit, and Ethereum sort of spun out of that. They were both in the booth, and obviously Anthony DiOrio was a big part of the early days. MadeSafe. So those would have been above that. Obviously, the jury's still out on Augur because it hasn't come out yet. But I think that one's got a lot of potential.
So MadeSafe really hasn't gone up in price at all. They still haven't even released their product yet, right?
Well, no, it did go up in price from the original market cap. So the original market cap, I think, was $5 million. Obviously, there were some things that were controversial, and it's all been gone over many times in terms of, you know, sort of the mistake of having it be over a platform where you were kind of, the preferred currency was MasterCoin, and then you had to kind of, you know, sort of exchange for Bitcoin. But
so one of the things we have tonight, we're actually this weekend we have a hackathon going on. Have you been involved in like the Texas Bitcoin Hackathon and such, like those?
I did the PR for both of the Texas Bitcoin.
Was BitAngels the company that like actually gave out the award there? Or who did
so
that?
It was actually MasterCoin that had the first award. And again, I did PR for them. Was never part of the founding structure or anything like that, and I did not participate in the initial ICO of MasterCoin, much to my chagrin, because it obviously went way up very fast.
Sure, yeah. What about although it's not so high up now, right? It's like there's not a lot of use for it yet.
There's a little bit of latent
development.
I think that it still has potential. It's obviously priced a lot lower now. Like Counterpart and like some other things, I'd say there's the coins that have fulfilled their promise, coins that have clearly not fulfilled, and coins where the jury's still out. And I would put both Omni and Counterparty in the jury still out category.
Are you an investor in Factum as well, or is that something that you've...
I did the original PR for Factum, and part of my payment was in Factum, so I've been happy with the return there.
So there's been a lot of people who speculated with like you and David Johnston's involvement, that a lot of these investments are actually done on or in OmniCoin. Is that the case?
Well, a number of the things, and again, David was the chairman of MasterCoin, chairman of Factum. I simply did the PR for both.
Sure.
I think it was logical for the early development of some of these coins that, if you're familiar with that protocol and working on it, to recommend to other folks to develop on it, just like obviously Storage was developed on and Swarm were developed on Counterparty.
Right. The reason I ask is actually Storage specifically was they were the winner of the Texas Bitcoin Hackathon. And after winning that hackathon, it was revealed to them that $500,000 prize was actually going to be paid in MasterCoin, which is quite a bit of money, especially in a market where there's something like $1,000 being sold every day. So, and I understand you're a large holder of MasterCoin. So there's allegations.
I'm not a large holder of MasterCoin.
You're not.
No.
So there are allegations that essentially what's going on here is that David Johnston is being asked to help people that are large holders in MasterCoin dump their MasterCoins for these other protocols, which is why you and him promote tokenization as much as you do.
So I'm not David.
Sure. But you are in BitAngels, and you do.
Right. So
you are
a
huge promoter of the tokenization in exchange for MasterCoin.
No, that's not correct. I started BitAngels with David when he started the DApps fund. He then left BitAngels in terms of the running of it, and ever since then, I've been the person who's been sort of responsible for the development of BitAngels going forward.
So why?
And BitAngels has never been, you know, certainly under my leadership,
sure,
trying to promote tokenization of MasterCoin.
Well, I mean, tokenization generally, though, right? You're a fairly large promoter of tokenization, like with the Factum project.
So BitAngels is a decentralized group of investors.
That's not a real idea. Right?
I'm sorry?
That's not really a real idea. A decentralized group of investors or individual investors who put their money into an angel fund.
No, it's not a fund. It's an angel group.
Okay.
It's a group like Band of Angels. It's not decentralized in terms of a protocol.
Sure.
It's the old version of decentralized, right?
Right? So it's a group of investors.
It's a group of angels, okay. Yes. And I would say when David was running it, there was probably more of a...
focus on tokenization.
My PR firm works with some companies that are tokens, some companies that are hardware companies, some companies that are software companies. I try to work with anything that I think is real and has a message, and then my firm Transform can be helpful.
There's a lot of controversy over tokenization as an effective tool for promoting or for really even building software.
Or even decentralizing.
Or even decentralizing, for that matter.
Because the economics are so difficult.
The allegation is that the tokenization comes first and that, in fact, the business model is merely to fundraise and to leave, I guess, the project to the community, quote unquote, at that time at which the developers can then exit. What would you say to that allegation? What studies or what math or what empiricism would you have to bring to the table on the effectiveness of this model as opposed to traditional VC vending and open source software development?
So it'd be interesting to actually have a researcher do sort of a study on it. I'm not a researcher. I'm a PR guy. And an investor, but I would say that my observation and opinion is that over the last couple of years, the model has moved from, hey, let's go out, write a white paper, and raise money based on that white paper, to we already have something built, let's raise money to do something with it. So it seems like the projects that are succeeding these days are further along.
And what about Voxel? For me, I've known a little bit about that project, and it seems like the lead developers know very, very little about blockchains, and that they are raising money for what is essentially a 3D software tool for which the tokens have been retroactively applied. Do you believe in that project at a great degree? Are you of the opinion that that is a well-run project that will be successful?
I think it's a well-run project, absolutely. And I'm not sure how you can say that the developers don't know anything about blockchain. The lead developer is Jim Blasko, who created Unbreakable Coin.
Well, it's pretty clear they don't. I mean, they tried to go after somebody who created a counterparty asset with their name.
No. Okay, so that, I will put this on the record.
Yes.
That is a complete fallacy.
It isn't. We saw the letters. We saw everything.
No, it's not. It's not. So what happened was somebody went and basically put up on CoinDaddy something fraudulent representing that.
Well, it wasn't fraudulent. It was a token. They tokenized Voxel on counterparty.
Nope, they didn't.
Exactly what happened.
No, they didn't. Voxel was already created by then, and somebody ended up putting up the stolen logo for Voxel that was created by Voxelus, and they put it up there and said it's for sale as a counterparty asset. And they wanted to sell the name first for $100,000, and then they came back and said for $300.
That's kind of interesting, actually. Yeah, I was wondering what the numbers were.
That's what Voxel says. Have you seen the emails from Voxel?
I have seen the emails, yes, from Voxelus. Voxel is the token.
Sure.
The reason I would allege that they don't know how blockchains work are a number of posts that they've made in their community.
Also that.
Whereby, I'm trying to remember it off the top of my head, but they made some statements that were just crazy about the nature of mining, such that it wasn't needed, yet that they were using Litecoin as their model.
Right.
So I think that there's been some very questionable posts by the lead dev. So maybe what we should do is get them on the show. Would you maybe want to arrange for that? Because I've tried and not been able to get him to expound on those statements.
So are you referring to the fact that it was built on Litecoin?
It's built on Litecoin, but they're taking the mining part out.
That's correct. It's a pre-mined coin, and there's a reason for that.
Well, what's the reason to use a blockchain then?
Or what's securing it, for that matter?
It's secured by mining, but it's not. But it's
pre-mined.
That's correct.
So what's the incentive to mine?
There is no incentive to mine. That's not the purpose of it.
So then, what's securing it?
Actually, Marshall Long's over here.
Marshall.
Oh, well, that's Marshall Long. There we are.
Marshall.
Is he involved in the Voxel project, or
He knows of the Voxel project, and they're basically. I thought I'd get a mining expert here because basically they're saying that a pre-mined coin can't have mining and can't be secure, and that's not true.
Yeah, it can't be secure.
Well, it can be secured by trust.
Right. No, it can be secured.
Is
this
a state coin or
we're talking about Voxel.
Oh, okay. So.
So it can be. It can. Now, obviously, something like Bitcoin that has thousands and thousands of miners will be more secure. Mm. But something that is a pre-mined coin that still has miners securing it and having transactions and having mining rewards is still secure.
Sure.
In fact.
Reward then?
So are we saying 100% is pre-mined? Is that?
We're trying to figure it out because the dev has been saying things that don't quite add up.
So and Voxel, so, and we're in at particular? Voxel in particular. Okay, so in Voxel's case, right? It's a token to provide for their new platform, right? And in general, the point of it is to facilitate quicker transactions online exclusively for their platform. So it's not really a peer-to-peer currency. It doesn't really have the same use cases
so
as, let's say, Bitcoin.
So it's just a centralized database that they're calling a blockchain?
No, it's an actual coin that has a blockchain that is a currency token specifically for their online platform. I mean, you can download a wallet, Qt, just like Bitcoin. However, Voxelis is using it as the maintaining party. Mining isn't being used for generation of new coins. It's simply being used to secure and authenticate transactions.
But so this is similar to, I mean, Ripple and some other coins.
So Ripple is more of the gateway thing, but yeah, it's mining does two things, right? It generates new coins, but it additionally secures and validates transactions.
Well, mining secures the chain, and coins are generated as an incentive for securing the chain.
But it's not the only incentive, right?
What is the other incentive?
The other incentive is if you're just completely altruistic, then you can just secure the blockchain.
We all know that's retarded. That's not what blockchains do.
Allegius allows 0% fees in their mempool.
And how many people? Absolutely. You can allow 0% fees, but that's not altruistic mining. You still get a reward when you throw the... You're talking about selfish mining.
No, I'm not. The pool operator in this case, Luke, being the pool operator, he's making nothing. It's actually costing him money to maintain, right?
Not really. It's negligible.
There's also benevolence involved. Like if and as the block becomes more constrained, those will go out.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. So it's a little bit of a scaling question, right? So
no, I mean he would not allow any zero fee transactions if the block was full.
I'm trying
and
to get
there
to
were
the
people tipping, but that doesn't matter that much.
Hold on, I'm trying to get the bottom of the technology though. Is this in fact a proof of stake chain then? That
no.
So what about it is mining?
Okay, sure. So in the Genesis block, you can put 100% of the coins. We'll say 99.99% of the
minus
coins.
The ones needed for
sure, and then you've got to have a little bit to facilitate the transactions going back and forth. So in this model, mining is strictly used to maintain the integrity and the validation of transactions from customer to Voxelis. That's it.
So is energy being burned for this?
Yes.
So as they perform work without a return, they are burning energy to do so?
Yes.
Spending money.
So does that sound kind of strange then, because what would happen is the person who spent more, who had an incentive to disrupt the system, would then have to spend a trivial amount of money in order to burn more energy than those guys.
Sure. So that gets to the question of, do you know where that source code lies? Because if not, then you can't get on the chain.
So the source code is closed then? Is that what
the source code for the mining is closed, and yeah. I'm not sure if it is or not, but in this case, I think it is, right? If it's not 100%.
It's revealed to the exchanges, and it will, sure. It will, like Ripple at some point, okay, be made open source, but not until the blockchain is more secure.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, basically, it's a digital asset, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and the point is that it's a digital asset that's purpose is digital asset, not the purpose of global decentralization.
Right.
There's other coins for that. The purpose is also not to make money for miners.
That doesn't make it
proof of stake.
Why doesn't Voxelis just use a centralized database and be the central trading repository for Voxelis?
That's not a cryptocurrency, right?
I mean, neither is this.
Yes, it is.
100%. It runs on SHA-256. That is a cryptographic algorithm.
But you said that there were two purposes to mining, one of which was to generate tokens and the other which was to secure the chain. And it seems like the security is just the obfuscation of the code and there's no coins being generated.
Security through obfuscurity is
does this
security.
Not,
yes?
Well, so the NSA is a blockchain? Like, what are, like,
no, hold on a second. So that would be your claim, is that security through obfuscation is security, which is fine.
Specifically, the chain's really short. It's a brand new coin, right? They haven't released the source code publicly, so you know if some farm threw down a bunch of hash rate on it, yeah, they would fork the ever-living crap out of it. Right?
Actually, though, there is code built in so that if anybody tried that, it would massively increase the difficulty.
Okay, sure. So
it would what?
Massively increase the difficulty.
So I'm
it recalibrates,
sure,
yeah, like 12-second block times or something like that?
Something like that.
I'm not sure if familiar with like the way that the difficulty works in Darkcoin or Dash now or like Unbreakable Coin, but the diff on Unbreakable Coin, holy crap, really high. And it's not worth it to mine it right now, if that makes sense. So if a bunch of hash rate came on, yeah, you might be able to fork a lot of it quickly, but the difficulty would go up so quickly, it probably doesn't make sense.
But you could understand, at least at some level, that the value proposition of the blockchain here is to further the crowdfunding efforts and not, in fact, to solve a problem that was needed.
No, it is to create an asset that can be used to buy virtual reality assets on Voxelis.
But you don't need
other
a blockchain for that, Michael.
You don't, but this is a cool way to make it like usable for their customers. That's it.
So it is literally just a pitch for investment?
No.
Okay, listen. This is
I think you're the guys that don't understand mining and blockchain here.
I love this troll fest.
I enjoy that a troll fest is when people ask you questions that are uncomfortable.
Sure.
But that's literally what you just said.
So, I just came in here. Tell me your question and see if I can answer it succinctly. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the question was literally, you said that the reason that they're doing it on a blockchain is because a blockchain is a cool way for them to distribute this asset and like to trade it, right? And our point was that the only reason to use a blockchain
to buy things on the Voxel's marketplace.
The only reason to use the blockchain rhetoric is to sell investment, and that they're better off just using a centralized database.
Okay, so here's a question. How would I, and I'm asking you this generally because I don't know, if I wanted to do this kind of shared database and I was an outside customer, you're not going to give me access to that, number one, probably, if you're a company. Number two, how can I... This is a quick way to facilitate transactions on their platform.
You don't need access to the database. You just need the ability to enter in. So, like, for example, if you're a gaming company and you build a game that allows you to trade on the Voxelist currency, you could do that, and they could just be the central repository. So just like MySQL.
How do you issue currency on this shared thing?
World of Warcraft does it every single day.
Sure.
I don't know, but you don't need a blockchain for it. And the only reason to use blockchain rhetoric in this instance seems to me to be to raise funds.
No, World of Warcraft also is not cryptographically secure, and this is the
first.
I
bet it is, though.
No, it's not.
Well, I wouldn't be able to know. So
I mean, I would imagine
it's not on a blockchain.
So cryptographic in this sense, right?
If you, Michael Turpin, is it your opinion that in order to be cryptographically secure, something has to be on a blockchain?
It helps.
How?
So you tell me how...
Didn't cryptography precede blockchains?
Of course, but the point is that World of Warcraft does not have cryptographically secure elements to it.
I would bet that it probably does. I would be surprised if it's SSL encrypted or something.
Maybe like an MD5 salt or something like that.
I would imagine the connection's even encrypted at this point, probably through some kind of basic SSL mechanism.
I think there's a reason it's rarely compromised, if ever.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about SSL, look at OpenSSL.
Here's the other question. Why is it even bad to just say, like, yeah, we are, in fact, promoting securities, and that these securities are able to be performed on a blockchain, and that's our job. So why is that a bad thing to say?
That's not the point of the token. The point of the token is to facilitate quick online transactions. So, I mean, I could have said, hey, give me a dollar, and I'll send you an email, and you can send it back.
We'll call that
our exchange of medium. However, you'll double spend the crap out of that, right? So...
Not if it's secured by trust and there's a central agency which manages that risk.
Is a blockchain faster than millisecond times that it takes to enter things into databases?
No, but if I don't want to use my credit card, how else would I do it?
I mean, you could create a central database that does exactly what the blockchain does.
So is your point that you need Bitcoin in order to buy these securities? That's the value add in a lot of cases?
If I said, hey, I don't live in your country and I don't want to use PayPal... And I don't know what Bitcoin is, but I know what this cool token is. And I want to, or let's just say I don't know any of that. And I have this marketplace that I want to interact with. How can I buy that asset? And in this case, how could I buy a Voxelist VR whatever? How could I do that?
Why couldn't you just take Bitcoin? Sure.
I mean, I could, but then I lose the branding opportunity of having my own cryptographic token. Yeah?
So we're back to this was just for investment.
I'm not saying investment. If I said, hey, let's make a
I was
going to
say, I could ask why Counterparty burned everything and why Counterparty exists at all.
Because Counterparty burned everything because, A, there's risk in raising money for securities, typically, and, B, the incentive structure would be such that being motivated by that burn would then cause the problem to stop the project to lose its motivation to develop.
Because the business would be the fundraising part.
Correct.
And people did buy Counterparty at $10 and now it's 60 cents.
They bought it not from the developers.
You know, I think for the most part, your position is obviously one that anything other than Bitcoin is questionable, and
no,
I don't
Mike,
agree with that.
We're clearly not pumping Counterparty here. Like, we don't care. If Counterparty doesn't work out, it doesn't work out.
Well, more
we,
so than that,
we happen to be
XCP,
Counterparty supporters, but we have no idea if it'll work out.
XCP is very tenuous at best. It's
absolutely
the Counterparty that, as a technology that we use.
Sure. So, like, the allegation
which relies
here,
on XCP.
It does not.
Yeah, I don't think you know how Counterparty works. But the allegation here is that the reason you're tokenizing things, and I think you've confirmed it, is in order to raise investor funds and to profit off the rhetoric.
I never said
blockchain.
Either of those things. You're putting
you didn't
word
say it,
in my
but
mouth.
That is what you said.
Well, hold on. Just back. Let me ask another question, though, of Michael. So there's been a trend lately to call tokens software licenses. Do you believe that tokens are software licenses?
One company, Factum, said that.
Yes.
We've been told that of a number of companies.
A number of companies
who
are switching
else?
To that.
I don't know.
Isn't Voxelist calling their software licenses as well?
No.
I'm not sure.
And wait, so Michael, you don't believe it's a software license. It is a share then of some greater source?
That's not what you said. You said that everybody's, and it's a trend that people are calling tokens software licenses.
That's perfectly fine.
That's one company. If you can't give me another example, then don't say that.
I can give you lots of people who do it.
Lisa people. Chang
talks about all of these tokens as software licenses. So we've heard it as a trend lately. But that's not even the point. The point is, do you believe them to be software licenses?
Well, typically when people say something's a software license, and I'm not currently working with Factum, so I can't comment on whether they're calling theirs a software license or not. But usually when someone says it's a software license, it's because it's, basically just the ledger part of it, and that it doesn't have anything that works with any kind of a cryptocurrency aspect.
In the case of Factum, do you believe they actually needed factoids, or could they just have had entry credits that you buy with Bitcoin?
You'd have to ask them.
I have a question for Marshall Longwall is here. Marshall, there are rumors that because of your Cripsy involvement, you have an investigation open with you from the SEC. Have you heard that rumor? Is that something that's news to you?
So in regards to Cripsy, I'll tell you what happened.
Sure.
I worked there from early January until September-ish.
This year?
Yeah. Okay. 2015.
All right.
Yeah. It was a good time. And then I left because I got busy with other stuff. That's it. And then after that, all this other stuff started happening. So, truthfully, I'm not sure.
But that wasn't the first exchange you've worked with, right? There have been a number of exchanges in the space?
No.
Weren't you with another investigation? No, I'm trying to remember that. I'll look that up. I may be wrong. If so, I apologize.
Are you still in contact with Big Vern?
I wish. I would love for him to say on his blog post, I was the only one who knew anything about this, because that would be the truth. But
yeah.
I've tried calling him 40 times.
Yeah, I've emailed him. He's not answering.
You and his wife, I'm sure.
Yeah, really. Well, I think that's it. You have any other questions for these?
No, I think
guys?
We're good. Thank you guys very much.
We really appreciate your time. We'd love to follow up with you maybe in a year or so. Let's see how some of these altcoins. I'm very bearish about these altcoins. I don't think that they're going to last. I think that they're bad value propositions. But obviously, you're on the other side of that debate. So fortunately, we'll be able to resolve this at some point. We shall see.
So you think Bitcoin is the only thing that will be worth more in 5 years than...
That's been the trend.
Let him finish.
Oh.
Then say Dash, Ethereum, name five others that are promising.
Yes.
Okay.
That's your opinion.
I would say
certainly is, yeah.
If Bitcoin isn't, that means that everything failed. It's almost like the S&P 500 of cryptocurrencies.
I would disagree with that. I think that the future is going to be, as I said sort of at the start of the interview, I think that in 5 years, Bitcoin will probably be something like 2/3 of the value of all digital assets, and there will be other digital assets through the market and through experimentation that rise to the top for certain things. I think rootstock is very interesting, and that's one-to-one, tradable for Bitcoin. I think that Dash is very interesting. I think there's a number of I think Ethereum remains very interesting.
How much do you know about rootstock, by the way?
I was there for the original white paper at La BitConf. I've spoken with Sergio and Diego quite a bit on it, and I think they're onto something.
The entirety of I love Diego. I love that guy. He's amazing.
Yeah.
The problem I have, there's two problems I have with rootstock. First and foremost, it relies on sidechains, which I'm a little pessimistic about. But second, it's a federated system, so it's inherently centralized in much the same way that Factum is. With you have 12 actors that are effectively controlling all of those transactions, which has a lot of counterparty risk.
And makes it not a smart contract.
You'd have to talk to Diego about that.
We will.
Exactly.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot. We appreciate it. That wraps it up for this episode. Hopefully, you found that kind of interesting. If you did, subscribe to the channel. We've got all kinds of cool content. Normally, we do content a little bit different. It's often just John, Seth, and I discussing the weekly news, but we have our own take on it. You might like it. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. You can subscribe to us on Stitcher. And check us out. You might find us, at the very least, entertaining, if nothing else. So hopefully we earned your business and you stick around.